We'll reconvene the hearing.
Commissioner Sinclair, just before you ask the next question, I have some information in relation to the previous question.
Yep.
So we talked about, you asked me about the default activity status and any preference of the council as to lines underground or overhead lines. Yeah. And redraft, I omitted to explain redrafted rule, recommended redrafted rule 30.4.22 on page 12 of the recommended revised chapter, and that's the rule that provides permitted activity status for the construction, alteration or addition to underground lines. So I will obviously bear in mind for the reply the status of that rule and how to manage that.
Okay.
It doesn't, it addresses the issue in the policy posing a preference over underground and overhead, but it doesn't solve the matter of lines and roads.
That's because it's a specific rule for lines and roads.
It's because the rules in the proposed chapter don't specify a zone. Specify that those activities apply to zones. Some rules apply to areas that are considered to be more sensitive, and they're identified as separate rules.
Mm.
But there's still that main difference between the proposed ban having a rule that applies district-wide and to all lands.
Mm.
And the operative district plan rule, the rule specified in all zones, which where there wasn't a zone meant that there was no rule.
Yeah. And how were roads treated in the proposed plan? Like, are they zoned or designated or nothing?
At this stage, they're designated, and that's in chapter 27. The designation hearing is in it, and this is coming up soon, so that matter will be addressed then. But we don't, as part of stage one, we don't have a transportation chapter, and we haven't dealt with the issue of whether or not to zone roads or to apply some sort of zoning to them. So that's
right.
Not an answer we have for you right
yeah.
now, sir.
Okay. Going back to the Health Department, your one. So if I can start with under issue one. Okay. Ignore the scope issues and on page 20, just in regard 20, 21, 22. How is the electricity transmission network defined? Well, this is the bit where it comes into 8.5, where there's, you've got the separate issue regarding sub-transmission.
Mm-hmm. So transmission lines, affecting transmission lines are defined, but it's inherent that transmission lines are on the national grid. The definition of national grid refers to the National Environmental Standard for Electricity Transmission Activities. But if you don't get any relief there, then by virtue of the definition of electricity, the recommended definition of electricity, sub-transmission lines, that only tells you things that are between 22 and 66 kV. So, there isn't an obvious definition that I can see of transmission lines.
Well, electricity transmission. It's in policy 30.2.6.4 on page 30.5. It refers to electricity transmission network, and then within the first bullet point it refers to the national grid, and the second one is the national grid. Would there be any advantage in, if it's the national grid that's being protected, just refers to it all as the national grid?
Rather than transmission lines in the...
Then there's electricity transmission network. I just see people saying, well, electricity, sub-transmission, that's a type of transmission as well, therefore that gets elevated to the same status as the national grid.
Yes, we're in policy 32.64 where it says efficient use and development of the electricity transmission network would mean if the national grid had the same meaning, would there be more?
I'm assuming that that's the same meaning that's intended, since it's the national grid that's got the national policy statement backing it up. So my next, sorting out that confusion within there, that's one thing, but the next one is, why is it that sub-transmission gets elevated to effectively, seems to me within here, the same status as national grid when the national grid's the only thing with a NPS backing it up? What is this about?
So which policy elevates sub-transmission relative to the national grid?
Well, you've got a specific, in 32.66, sub-transmission lines are separately identified in there. Listen, why is sub-transmission being separated out? Whereas under the NPS, either everything's national grid, which is what the transmission's about, everything else is just electricity distribution. So I think it's wider than just any of the question's wider than just any of the particular policies or that, but it, you've established that first and then being able to work out how the rest of this is structured. I'm kind of looking for justification for why sub-transmission needs to be addressed at all. Apart from what seems to be that Aurora asked for it. In terms of
that's definitely the flavour that's come through in the recommendation. The other issue obviously is that I don't, not thinking you were pretty obviously clear, but Transvaal sort of regarded policy 3264 as their own, so it was considered appropriate to have a standalone policy that manages distribution. I don't think it necessarily elevates distribution or sub-transmission to the same status as transmission.
But doesn't it, that because it's got, that sub-transmission's got its own, I thought I'd seen in here some additional rules and that related.
There are, sir.
To it.
The rules aren't as, they don't have a higher, the depth of protection isn't as high as the transmission.
So when you're talking about what's the rule 30.510, which is about electricity sub-transmission, it's on page 3018. It's about all of those bits, but what's, how do you get an elevated status to provide this type of rule different from any other form of distribution? I'm just calling them all, anything that's not national grid is distribution, therefore why does this electricity sub-transmission corridor? I'm trying to understand the justification for that. Fundamental question right away, but if you can give that some more thought, come back to us. Infrastructure mindsetings in the proposed RPS. And when I was last here, someone said, oh, decisions are due in September. But September, can you update us on whatever the latest out is? The Otago Regional Council in regard to when they might release or not release any decisions?
No.
No? Okay. No, that's fine.
I mean, as much as checking website weekly.
Okay.
Well, I can say I checked the website over the weekend and now it says early October.
Based on which I assume in early October, it's early November. Yeah. Okay. You've got a change to the definition of this regionally significant infrastructure. And in that, it refers to a telecommunication and radio communication facility. Can you explain to us what do you think it means by facility? What's the term facility in that relative to telecommunication and we'll start with that.
It could be to do with the land that covers the activity and infrastructure without any security being a structure or a building on its own. So does that encompass under the word activity? Potentially, but where I'm getting at is that it could be the slightly broader concept than just activity on its own. It could be the sort of area that might be denoted by that operator to be perhaps it could be designated, or perhaps it could be identified in some other way, but it might not. Perhaps the people's activity instead, that might be too narrow.
Because back where it's got telecommunications facilities on 21 and the other notes 22, it includes all aerial dishes, antenna, Wi-Fi, microcells, lines including cables, casings, tunnels, associated equipment and support, etc., telecommunication kiosks, and anything for that. So when I see that, that's not a facility, that seems to me to be the entire network, their entire network. So my question is, if that's the case, is that, and when you look at the rules, doesn't that pretty much make anything they want almost a permitted activity?
I was looking at the relationship between the definition, the recommended definition of regional infrastructure, and then you pointed out to me the definition of telecommunication facility. So what corresponding rule service is one?
The TD.4.13, with a maximum height no greater than what, 12 metres. So if it's a facility, now I'm assuming that if it's their entire network, then telephone exchanges are included in that as well. So providing you've got a telephone exchange and it's no greater than 12 metres, you just build it as a permitted activity. Almost anywhere according to that. In any other zone, and it falls on. I did wonder what would happen if you built it on a road. It's just that the way the definitions are set out, that it seems to include a large facility that I've heard in the past telecommunications companies have told I'm aware that they think that telecommunications facility designed and defined under the Telecommunications Act is their entire network. Whereas for radio communication facility, it might be a site where there's some antenna and a building and that kind of thing. That's a facility. It's kind of like all facilities are networks, but not all networks are facilities. So, I don't know, we'll no doubt be asking them the same questions when they turn up in the next couple of days. But it just seems to me that it's quite wide in terms of what a communication facility could be. So you don't even need to worry about it. This only becomes a controlled activity if it's over this height. But why do you have new buildings and structures ancillary to or associated with utilities? They're permitted, but only if it's less than 10 square metres and less than 3 metres in height. But if it's something like an exchange as a facility, then they'll be arguing, well, hang on, under 3413, we can build it as of right.
Thank you. Something to think about too.
Could I just, while we're looking at that, Rod, your earlier discussion of the situation where roads have no underlying zoning, that rule doesn't provide any exclusion outside of zones. So even if it wasn't a telephone but radio transmitting mast, it wouldn't have any height limit if it was located in a road reserve.
That would be discretionary.
I'd need to look at that, I think.
Page 25, your evidence for 19, just read out in the critical electricity lines. Again, it seems to be something where this has been elevated to a status above and beyond the national grid, which has the NPS backing for it. How does that, is the justification for determining what's a critical electricity line? Shouldn't they just be like all other lines, whether it's distribution, or whether they should all be treated the same?
Made the distinction in the recommendation that the sub-transmission is between 22 and 66 kV, so it's not the smaller 11 kV line. I note your comment around the elevations or the status of it relative to the NPS and the trans and the national grid. It was the intent to make it a second tier below the transmission line for the national grid, so that's something I'll go away and take a look at.
As you said, why is it for, at the NPS level, they've gone to a whole lot of justification and it's the national interest to have that. Why is it that similar provisions can be put in the plan without I'm trying to understand what's the justification for separating it out when in other parts of the country nobody's ever bothered to do that before. There was one part a bit later on where I think it's and I'll find it probably because I highlighted it later on, where it talked about Wellington and Tauranga being areas where provisions to, I think it's around telecommunication, were brought in. But it's like, well, that might be fine, but Wellington plan was brought in before the RPS was made operative, whereas in there I would look at Pōrua, Hutt City and Upper Hutt, with recent plan changes where issues around that elevation and discussing telecommunications facilities has been addressed. I should declare that I was on the panel for the Upper Hutt and Rangiroa ones, hence some of the questions. In terms of 9.16, which is about the definition of the electricity distribution, I just wanted, probably because I couldn't find it, where does that distribution fall into any particular rules that relate just to the distribution, or is it silent on that matter?
Only so far there's the rule, recommended rules for the sub transmission lines, and they're the rules to protect that corridor.
Right.
And a policy, a recommended policy that we've discussed before around review sensitivity. That's 2.6.6. Rule 35.10. So that's the consequence of having to find what we're calling the sub-transmission corridor and providing a regular story.
Yeah. Okay. Electricity distribution corridor in 9.20. Do you know how that's addressed in other districts down this way or anywhere else?
Not off the top of my head, sir.
No. In 9.26, talking about the support structures. Zach, electricity poles in which electricity and telephone cables and all that are attached to. Who owns the poles? Do you know? Telephone, the local lines company, I don't actually know, so I'm trying to work out who owns the poles, therefore who's effectively got control of the structures and where they go, in order to be able to understand then how the rules might actually play out.
Is it that important as to the ownership? Because an agreement can be made between two parties, and then it really comes down to what the regulatory framework is and the effects that they contemplate. I mean, the council is sort of powerless if let's say Aurora owned the pole and it was sitting in Aurora's easement. If a third party came along and wanted to utilise that, the district plan wouldn't necessarily be able to gear towards that, would it? It's more about the effects of the...
What I'm trying to understand is the difference between lines and supporting structures, which I think are controlled when you're talking about to convey electricity and any other purpose, including telecommunications.
Were you wondering if different utilities on the same structure had a different status?
Yeah, and we're here. Yep. Okay. where it talks about supporting structures, masts, poles and ancillary equipment, does it envisage that it includes things like, retaining walls, or I'm trying to work out are there other issues about the management of utilities that might include retaining walls or other support structure thing where someone has to do that in order to put a pole or something on top of it?
The recommended on page 23 of the appendix 1 to that, on the recommended revised chapter, the recommended definition of support structure says means a utility pole or tower that forms part of the electricity distribution system that supports conductors as part of a line. So I think that's reasonably clear in that it's limited to the pole or tower and structures on the pole or tower, not retaining walls or other structures.
And is there the difference between the supporting structure and telecommunications facility? Can you get, is the definition of supporting structures sufficient in order to show that the difference between a telecommunications mast and a supporting structure? I mean, you're not going to want to go for a supporting structure, I suppose it's controlled activity, when the facility's permitted up to a certain height anyway. They're sort of trying to work out the make sure that you're not confusing one with the other if you try to ask in order to gain an advantage. She's suggesting it might be sufficient in terms of the definition of support structure because it includes conductors as part of a line. Going back to sub-transmission, have you mapped it all where all those sub-transmission lines are so that you could understand the extent of what's being requested and where it applies?
Aurora have provided the location on a relatively large scale map, and the recommendation directives that need to be included but haven't looked underneath where everyone would be.
Yeah. Do we have that? Was it included in there?
It's in Aurora's evidence.
It's in the original.
Yeah, there's a note in the Poisway report that if this is accepted, that would be a consequential change for the need to get planning maps.
Majority of relief sort is consistent. This is 9.42 on page 32. this minor upgrading, that's possibly where it fits. The plans consistent with, I'm sure they see, Wellington City and Carolina. I just wondered whether looking at the Pōrua, Hutt City and Upper Hutt examples might provide something different that you might like to just check. For that.
Thank you.
And it says in B there, I'm not sure if this was translated through to the in that same paragraph there about minor upgrades being of similar scale and intensity. In terms of the word similar, did that get transferred into the definition? It's just that it's a is it the same as it is in 11 or 10 or
yes, it's on page 30, 19. So the recommended definition does include that.
I just want to check whether it's, is that the same word and it's a similar, slightly vague?
Yes.
But I wondered whether section 11 or 10 or whatever they are changing it.
Same or similar in character and intensity and scope.
Same or similar.
I'll have a look at that word and that phrase.
Yep.
Thank you.
Similar scale. Not scale. In section 10A, the scale as well. Similar scale. Similar in character, intensity, and scale. And this one says similar scale, intensity, and character. So the section 10 is a different way around.
Are you referring to 10A of the Act?
Yes.
The phrase needs to be there if it's in 10A of the Act. Something slightly beyond that, would they not?
No, I think what Commissioner Sinclair is getting at is that the phrasing in section 10A is well understood what it means. If we use the same words, there can't be a dispute as to what is meant.
One of those rare occasions where parroting what's meant might be useful. The next one in the minor upgrades for 942, and then looking at the recommendation. In terms of a minor upgrade, it's increasing the carrying capacity, efficiency, etc. Similar scale, intensity, and character. The addition of lines or circuits, it just seems that you could potentially add quite a bit to an existing facility, and whether it's trying to work out what's a minor upgrade and when this becomes made, it's trying to get just some understanding around what the trigger would be to shift from one to the other. And just to be clear for my understanding, the minor upgrading, this applies to all the poles and lines and all that sort of thing on the street, as well as any that happen to be placed on the crossover was sitting on a piece of land that's actually got a zoning for it. Is that correct?
That would be correct. Just not drawing an extension between those two scenarios.
And then going back to this definition of telecommunications facility and what's meant by that, think of this, the entire network. Where does the entire network or the facility start and stop? So does it stop on the street, or does it go into the line that runs from the pole on the street to someone's house on the same telecom chorus, whatever you call it now? They own all of that right up to the house. So it's more about, is there anything in the rules that, you know, if you're only thinking about the zoning for stuff on the street, that might be one thing, but when it goes across private property, is there any reverse sensitivity issues or things like that that you're supposed to, you're trying to protect infrastructure from reverse sensitivity issues? Minor upgrades now, just in terms of, is there anything in regard to lines and where a telecommunications facility starts and stops? But is there any implication if it's with the line isn't not on a road, but it goes right up and into somebody's property? So it could well be that there's not. The situation I've come across is where there was a strong focus in this plan change to protect infrastructure from reverse sensitivity issues, and by having it as the entire facility needing the entire network, that means that pretty much the entire region wherever there's a telecommunication line could trigger the need for resource consent if you were doing anything on a property, anything related to it. So that might not be the case here, and I'm just trying to check that. Right, so the next one, Mr. Barr?
Yes, sir.
Cool. 948, just around the sensitive activities. Is that part there in terms of sensitive activities and TransPower's view on them and that kind of thing? Is that all sorted now? Effectively,
don't know if you've got a chance to look at the evidence.
I have read, sir. I'm just struggling my words. I haven't got the answer in front of me without having to go through the evidence, so I'll just.
Line 54 in terms of NCTAs. Submission.
I
didn't quite understand that as the definition of a utility, a utility network. Does NZTA's roaming network constitute a utility under the definition of in the RMA?
By virtue of them being included in Section 166 of the Act, that does include them, the EBCA say as much in their evidence.
So, it's just about cycleways, roads, and walkways. What's it, rails? Do you know what they mean by that?
Probably trails, sir.
Oh.
I don't think they're too concerned.
Oh, there's a team missing.
Yeah, the team.
Oh, okay, right.
Spell check.
Yeah. So you'd be making a distinction between the actual road in terms of the network and then the cycleway, trails, or walkways that are associated or ancillary to it? How?
In that much, if the NZTA wanted to, and it's certainly not trying to discourage the NZTA from constructing things like cycleways, trails, and walkways, in addition to roads, NZTA being a requiring authority and the network, and identified as a network utility operator, can they have quite a few mechanisms to facilitate those processes. But if somebody else wanted to build a mountain bike track somewhere for some reason, whether it be for their own recreation or for the commercial recreation activity, that could have an adverse effect. And I don't think it's contemplated in the utilities chapter for those persons to be undertaking those activities through that chapter.
This
so,
sort of the definition of utility, though, as in chapter 2, already include those matters because it says means the systems, services, structures, and networks necessary to operate and supplying essential utility and services to the community, and then it gives a list which is not limited. So, I think those things are inherently within that definition, irrespective of whether it's added to the list or not.
Also, whether the something like the requirements under the Main Transport Act or one of those other types of things where in terms of delivering road and network, NZTA need to consider a whole lot of other things about alternatives and things like that, whether that by association brings it in.
Well, I'm not so much worried about the status of the NZTA, but just going back to Mr. Nugent's comment, I don't necessarily agree that anybody building a track would be included in the definition of utility, and not not 100% clear, but would somebody building a track for your own recreation or for somebody else's, if they profited from that, that be an essential utility?
Is there any limitation in terms of who can take advantage of the utilities rules within the plan, sort of in the same way in the RMA, to be a network requiring authority and all that kind of thing, network utility operator, specific provisions around that?
Other district banks I'm familiar with do have that as a qualifier. It makes life simpler from an administration perspective, but I don't think this is stated in this one, and I think we need to rely on that definition of utility. As a third party, putting on a consent plan as that, if a third party or somebody came along and they didn't qualify as a network utility operator, and they said they wanted to undertake works, or they qualified this definition of utility, I'd ask them if what they were doing was supplying an essential utility and service to the community. Because regardless of the not limited to and the following qualifiers, I think that statement and that sentence is something I'd be hanging on to.
A bit of a problem when you've got someone like the Cotterby Trails Trust and the Upper Clutha Trails Trust who arguably are providing the service to the community and building trails, and there may be an issue that needs to be addressed in that respect, and that is that the council is seeking not to broaden it to outside of network utility operators. Mm-hmm. Maybe the solution is to restrict the chapter to them.
Put what code, sir?
Well, variation.
Thank you.
Because under the definition of utility includes anything described as a network utility operator under 166, so if NGTA are there, then their stuff would be in.
That's what I said. Yeah, that's my response.
But it's more about, you know, how the
that's one
others.
That's one of the non-limiting inclusives. Turning to the objectives and policies of page 30.2, and the first objective there, again, I think this comes into your category of not being able to be, there are no submissions on it, because I think that's correct. It's just, it talks about the benefits being recognised, but in an objective it's like the recognition of a benefit doesn't, it's not really an outcome, mm-hmm. or whatever. So it's just one of the ones where you recommend that it be changed, but you can't because it's outscoped.
That's one of the sermon I haven't really tampered with. I'm familiar with the remarks you've made, but council officers and other submitters around this, the merit of the word recognised and it's effective. Mm.
The next one starts with recognise as well. Mm.
It would be difficult to change or replace the word recognise without making a substantive change.
Yeah.
So I haven't recommended a change.
Right. Fair enough.
30.2.7. This is when we're talking about chapter 3 and 6 and the high value landscapes, which could be what O&Ls and O&Fs in the lease. It's a matter of the objective is to avoid remedy or mitigate in order to be consistent with chapters 3 and 6. Which one should it be?
I could say it would depend on the context and the scale of effect relative to the resource that could be affected, but perhaps I would have preferred something along the lines of protect and maintain, or some wording that was consistent with strategic directions and landscape chapter, or at least the council's reply version. Perhaps there weren't. I will revisit it further, but I don't know if there's much ability to change that, and at least we can please qualify as around managing the effects of activities.
Thank you very much. That's it.
I think ridiculous the insignificant, but that is so much. Okay.
Yeah.
Just about just going back to this issue of Aurora's mission and the sub-transmission network, which you seem to agree with their submission on having redrafted rules, etc. Are you aware how many people, how many landowners would be affected by those rules?
No, but a lot, and they're mostly in the rural zone.
Sorry to interject,
but I might, without knowing the details, they well and truly could be easements effectively securing some sort of right over that landlord's land in favour of Aurora.
Yes.
In any case.
Although, when I was the only one who did, who had Aurora in the subdivision chapter, they said that this was particularly directed to where they didn't have easements. When you, I have to confess, I haven't looked at your section 32AA in detail. Did you, as part of consideration of alternatives, consider the alternative of Aurora looking at that as a requirement to have those rules applied in respect of their lines?
Not overtly, because it's not tabled as such, but that issue has been with me while I've been considering this submission.
And the other thing that I'm wondering if you considered was whether by including these rules, whether the council is imposing additional charges on landowners to get a resource consent application when a regime exists under the electricity code for them to get Aurora's approval for free. And if it was a designation in place, the approval under section 1676 wouldn't cost landowner or anything either. Is that a yes? You did consider it, or no, you didn't?
No, I haven't considered that yet.
Right. Okay. And then the final matter to consider, which perhaps is one that's from one of these retreats as well, is whether there's a matter of natural justice that there are potentially a large number of landowners affected by this submission. Through, as far as I know, and I haven't had the opportunity to ask Aurora yet, as far as I know, we're not advised by Aurora that that submission was being lodged, and probably had no knowledge that that potentially form could affect it. And to be honest, for some of the submissions would not be an obvious place to look.
Despite, in addition to the obvious goods of veterans.
Well, some of these things are changes in the zoning, and you can look at how your land is affected, but the submission contained a map that has a series of lines on it. It didn't indicate any lot boundaries. It would be hard to know whether you were present. You'd have to look for the submission first, and then you rethink it.
Was the map that you referred to with the lines on it, that's in their evidence only, I take it, not in...
That's in their submission.
In their submission as well, I take it.
Yes.
Because it's a non-compliant activity status under the rules, but... Section 17 within the electricity sub-transmission corridor. Yet it's only a discretionary activity when it comes from NPS for the one below. Well, that's also.
The rule, numbered rule 359, it is not compliant as well, and that's...
Oh, okay, yep, I see. Yep.
Yeah.
That's good.
I mean, your comments you made before around the potential elevated status of these sub-distribution lines, I'll go away and take further thought, but I was just thinking, comparing those two rules, the rules relating to the national grid, constraining activities with the national grid corridor, seems a bit more restrictive than the sub-transmission. So does that not help?
Explain the sort of gaps between those two. Possibly in regard to building and some structures, but not in regard to earthworks. Because structures and earthworks and stuff are both non-compliant, whereas with the national group, buildings and structures are non-compliant, but earthworks are discretionary. But I think it's more fundamental about why is it in there for sub-transmission in the first place anyway.
Gave me the opportunity to quickly look at the code attached to Mr. Sullivan's evidence for Aurora. Have you had a chance to look at that?
Yes. The main matter that I noted from that is that Mr. Sullivan's evidence seems to want to protect the 11 kV lines in about half a dozen locations, whereas Ms. Bowes' evidence only wants protection of the 11 kV line from Canada or basically from Wanaka to Aurora. So it might have been another matter that you picked up.
Well, the more general matter is that it seems that the code is mandatory that irrespective of what else you do, any person has to comply with this, and that requires obtaining consents from the lines operator. So, if there's a rule in the district plan that requires a consent, it's not actually removing or replacing that requirement, is it?
No, I wouldn't
think.
It's duplication.
It doesn't. It still means they still have to go and get the consent, so it's not.
Is there a case that's a better management of that resource to have rights and rules in the district plan, right? Or the general?
Well, I don't have the answer to that, but the general approach that the council has been promoting in the other sections of the plan is minimising duplication and obtaining consents from
consistently.
Thank you, United.
I think it's fair to say you're not the only person we had to ask these questions on this. Moving on from there, just we were discussing the definition of utility before. And Queenstown Airport made some submissions suggesting that there's a, because of the way the definition is framed now and encapsulating all network utility operators, it creates a different categories of consents required for their own buildings within the airport area as opposed to private operators. Do you think it's possible that rather than the convoluted effort that it seems as though Sullivan is proposing, whether it might be simpler to change the definition to make it explicit that it is to do with the utility aspects of the network utility operator that it's referring to, not all their activities? Or is it even, or could we just exclude the airport?
Excluding the airport might be as any good utility operator, not the airport as a zone.
Yes.
Yes, because then one thing I thought about with Mr. Sullivan's evidence is that it also disqualifies other utilities from being able to benefit from that chapter in that zone.
Yes. So, yeah. It's worth checking because it seems to be the simplest approach, and I'm not sure that they are not otherwise able to do the navigation facilities as a utility anyway without being specific things, but you might like to check that and maybe
with the requirement of authority status also trump those rules and this issue as well?
Well, especially if they use the notice of requirement process, which I think they generally do for their activities outside of the airport anyway.
But within the zone?
Well, I'm thinking of things like the VORs, etc., on top of Morgan Hill.
Yes, but this issue's confined to just the relationship between...
Yes, but I don't want to remove the utility status.
I see. Yeah, overall.
Yes.
Understood.
Yes. I'll start with going through the revised chapter 30, because that will probably bring up all the matters that I've got for this session, 2A report. Just on page 1, and I do this reading, I think you will not be able to look at the report. In the last paragraph, the second to last sentence, I think it may have. That may be the wrong way around. It is essential utilities are protected from further encroachment by incompatible activities which may be subject to reverse sensitivity effects. I think it should be, and correct me if I'm wrong, that it should be incompatible activities which may lead to reverse sensitivity effects.
That sounds clear, sir.
In objective 30.2.4, I just want to check, I don't think this is a substantive change, but it says site layout. Would it be clearer if it says subdivision layout? So I think that's what's intended. Or is it the layout of things on the site?
Yes, I think it's both, because policy 244 talks about encouraging certain star rating. So it could well be to do with...
But that's building design, isn't it?
Yes, which is not to do with subdivision. So it might be the layout of building on site. So I think it's more encompassing than subdivision on its own. Well, that's a... objective was changed to subdivision site layout or more, then that policy could be left hanging, would it not?
Well, I'm just wondering because, I mean, certainly the subdivision policy 4.2 is about designing subdivision to utilise energy efficiency, etc. And that was, there's a similar policy in chapter 27 that we've just dealt with. And maybe it should be subdivision layout and building design and site layout. Something like that. If it's intended that the layout of the buildings on the site is there, then I just think site layout, the word misses subdivision.
Yes, I'll have a look at section 32 and see if it's...
Yeah.
Look into the objective and look at some submissions and see.
Going over to page 7 and 30.335. Is there a rule or an advice note?
That says utilities can also be provided a designation?
Yes.
Um, I think we have a role in telling somebody to get right for us to get information. That's an advice note.
So it is an advice note. What I'm interested in is the list of things that are listed that are made a discretionary activity. Where it says heritage, comma, features and landscapes, I presume the comma's a mistake. Is that correct?
Think so, I can't see how else it
would
make sense or apply to another
type
of innovation.
That's what I was hoping. And then the next one, I'm just a bit confused. We've got that if it's an outstanding natural landscape or standing natural feature, that's discretionary, and then it says all the other zones of outside a building platform. Is that intentional? So that it's in...
Which one's the thing?
It's the immediately following after heritage features. I'm just checking that the intention is to pick up all the other rural land where it's not within an ONL or an ONF. Is that the intention?
Yes.
Okay. So, well, is my related question, or is it related to, because it's outside of a building platform, if it was inside a building platform, the issue would have been addressed already in the rural chapter or the subdivision chapter, wherever it's.
Yes, and that is developed or is contemplated to go. That's correct. I'm just trying to think on the fly about the just because outstanding natural features and landscapes are classifications and the rural zone is the entire zone.
I don't think that's necessarily an issue.
Okay.
I was just checking if that was the intention. Now, on the top of the next page, this is in rule 34.4. And that's supposed to be the last bullet point of the matters of discretion. Is that a matter of discretion?
Quite a broad one.
Is it a matter of discretion or a standard?
One is a natural hazard. Is this the first time the family has come across this matter of discretion?
Yes, it's been heard several times, but yes.
So my understanding of it is that it's quite a specific, defined, intended to be a very specific matter of discretion.
Well, but if it requires the assessment by a qualified person, Where's the discretion that's saying that if it's subject to a natural hazard, you have to have an assessment?
Well, should it be both a matter of discretion, shortened up, and set as a standard as well?
Yes, but as a standard, it would be hinging on a report by a suitably qualified person, which is an issue on its own. And I appreciate that, isn't it?
Well, it seems to me, isn't it, saying that where you have one of these proposed activities and there's an actual hazard, the council wants a report from a qualified person to say there's not going to be a problem. Isn't that what is actually stalled from this bullet point?
Yes, that's the intent.
That to me is a standard that the report is lodged with the application. If you don't lodge the report, then you're not restricted to discretionary. If you do lodge the report, then the matter of discretion includes consideration of the report. That's how I think it should be. And that's, I think, what the council is intending.
Okay.
And I saw that the same one in 34.11, 34.17, there may be others.
Thank you, I'll put some thought into that.
In 13.4.6 with the non-renewable electricity generation, in the second bullet point, you talk about remote sites. I'm just wondering whether that requires some better definition. I know what the intention is, places where there is no distributed power supply.
Is it remote in terms of from the distribution point of view, or remote in terms of geographic isolation?
Yes.
Geographic location.
Yeah. Well, I mean, certainly you have to take branches station or water peak. Those sort of places, there is no distributed power supply and they are remote. But I'm always a bit wary of having a word that has a generality of meanings in there that could have unforeseen consequences.
Thank you, Colin.
There's a number of things in here that are referring to matters which are probably going to be in stage two of the plan, and I'm working on the basis that they'll be notified before we finalise these. So I'm not going to question you on
that. Thank you.
In 34.11, that last bullet point, which is the natural hazard one, I just noted that the footnote didn't copy over. But if you don't change it, that footnote could probably go to something. Still on page 10, in 30.4.12.5, what is this?
It's my problem.
Is it? Just drop over the business tag. Was that something put into the operative plan that's been rolled over?
proposed to be those. Now, I'll have another look, but we did look for submissions on this for explanation and for more any bit of certainty we can get out of this, such as a zone, I think, by.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
In fact, one of the submitters had comments on that matter, but I don't know if it's in an original submission, so to speak. There might be more.
And we've got on page 14, rule 30.4.23, we've got the same thing here. Where it talks about full works undertaken in activity area 11, no, 1F of the Trotter Country Special Zone. That's possibly just another rollover.
We'll be able to provide you more information on that, by the status of that zone.
Yes, that's helpful. It may well be too that by the time these rules become effective, that's an unnecessary rule. In the same way as the rule about the roundabout on State Highway 1 to access the Shriver Country subdivision is.
Thank you.
Now, in the standards, rule 30.5.13, I'm not sure that I understand what's meant here. Does that mean, particularly the exemption for accessory buildings, does that mean that the solar panels cannot be fixed to an accessory building which is within a setback?
Yes.
Right, that's the easiest.
On the same reading, or on your suggestion, what I can think of here is the permitted setback for accessory buildings in the local to residential zone.
And large lot residential happens there, don't they?
They will do.
Yeah. The rural residential does.
I'm not sure if it does.
It may not be, but it's in the offering thing.
Just to make it more clear, sorry, possibly not, when I read that, I thought it was that it's not because we are sitting on top of an accessory building. My assumption was that the generation or heating thing was attached, just sitting on the ground. Therefore, it couldn't be within the normal boundary setbacks applied to it. And that if there was is there any exemption for accessory buildings and side yards?
Yes, there are.
Okay. Well, then I thought it was that didn't apply exemption specific. So you can't build. If this is your unit, you can't stick it in the side yard there. It's not about whether you're sticking it on top of an existing building that's sitting within the.
I agree. That's my first reading of it, but also what Mr. Nugent raised around, installing those
on top of
would also apply the way it's phrased, and I will have a look and see if that's the intent and if there's a scope to make any changes.
We'll adjourn to the afternoon,